Good morning. It is 7 minutes past 6 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm going to be here today and this week for Joy Cardine. Well, the debate over the debt ceiling issue is finished for the moment, and here's the way it sounded yesterday. President Obama at a news conference saying the debt deal is a good start, but that there's more work to do.
This compromise guarantees more than $2 trillion in deficit reduction. It's an important first step to ensuring that as a nation we live within our means. Yet it also allows us to keep making key investments in things like education and research that lead to new jobs and assures that we're not cutting too abruptly while the economy is still fragile.
And on the other side, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Now, this bill does not solve the problem, but it at least forces Washington to admit that it has one.
And so now what happens now? Will we notice changes now that we've got a deal? And if so, when? And does the end of this round of debating on the debt ceiling topic mean that we're finished with it for a while? Our guest this hour is Melissa Miller, political science professor at Bowling Green State University, and she'll be helping sort through the legislation and its effects and what could happen next. What questions do you have about how this debt ceiling deal is going to work? Is there anything that you particularly like or dislike about it? And what kind of impact, if any, do you think that this agreement will have on your personal situation, your finances? Join the discussion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join us on email. That address is talk@wpr.org. And don't forget that you can follow the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook as well. Melissa Miller, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you, and good morning to you, Gene.
Well, it is good to have you along, and I want to kind of start with a general question. Given everything that we've been hearing for the past couple of weeks, do you think this was about as good a deal as we could have gotten at this point, or could more have been done?
Boy, that depends on, if you pose that question to a House Democrat, they'd probably say this was not the best deal. You pose it to Mitch McConnell, he might say yes. It's really all in the eyes of the beholder. Although I would have to say, I don't think anyone, any of these key players, whether it be the House or the Senate leadership, Democrats or Republicans, are thrilled with the plan. I think that's reflected in what we just heard, those sound bites from Mitch McConnell and President Obama.
Yeah, it's interesting because practically every news conference, every comment we've been hearing from anybody who's been involved in this for the past couple of days, it always starts with, you know, what they don't like about the plan. And it seems like that's pretty much universal on all sides of the issue. Is there anything that people really do like about it, or just the fact that it is a first step?
Well, I think one thing that may be getting lost a little bit in all of the complaining, if you will, about, you know, what each side didn't get or how much they had to compromise is that one thing we know for certain is that had a deal not been brokered, had it not been signed into law yesterday by the president, the United States would have certainly faced a credit downgrade. That AAA bond rating, which we enjoy, which keeps our interest rates low, and, you know, that was at great risk. Now, with the deal that we got, it's still somewhat at risk. In fact, although Moody's and Fitch said yesterday that they would wait and see and weren't going to do anything immediately, Standard & Poor's and its rivals have signaled that there might be a downgrade, so we're still in this situation of uncertainty. But again, what may be getting lost is, I'll use the phrase that I've heard a lot have used, you know, we didn't really go flying off the cliff here, so that's the good piece of it. We avoided an absolute certain credit downgrade, which would have affected everybody, every borrower, whether you were trying to buy a home or a car or pay for student loans or what have you. So that's really the good piece of this deal.
And one of the things we're going to be talking about this hour is the impact that this is going to have on average people, because we've been talking about driving off that cliff for a while, and now that the deal is done, now that there is all these various mechanisms in place, what are our actual people on the ground going to see? And one of the things that we've been talking about a lot is this credit downgrade that you mentioned, or the potential for a credit downgrade. And, you know, as you say, it remains to be seen whether this is going to happen or not. But it's already had an impact, I think.
Well, it's had an impact in the sense that the markets were down yesterday. Already today, the foreign markets are down. You know, I think the hope was that a deal would be reached and the markets would be calmed, that, you know, we were able to deal with this tough situation and broker a deal. And yet the markets didn't respond, you know, with a lot of enthusiasm. And part of the reason is that so much of the big decision-making is yet to come. So what markets like is certainty. And what they got was still a good deal of uncertainty. So the short-term effects are not necessarily going to be noticed very much by average Americans. I say that because the only thing that happens sort of right away is a relatively modest $25 billion in cuts that are pretty widely spread. I'm not sure that Americans are going to feel, you know, a big hit in terms of programs and things that they enjoy. The bigger cuts are yet to come. And as well, we get the $25 billion in cuts in the first fiscal year that begins in October, and then $900 billion in cuts spread over 10 years. And the exact allocations are yet to be determined by Congress for those $900 billion, but they will come from discretionary programs. So these are things that Congress has discretion over. These aren't programs where there's a formula, let's say, to determine eligibility, which is why you don't see Social Security cuts, for instance, already included. That may come later. Those things may be on the table when the super committee convenes, which they are mandated now by law to do, and come up with a plan by November. So in the short term, I don't know that we'll feel these big effects, aside from, boy, it's certainly nice that we weren't downgraded. That's the big immediate effect. And perhaps the conversation will shift a bit to some other important topics, such as jobs. I think that's where Americans are probably most concerned right now anyway.
One of the things I want to do is put some of these figures we hear into some sort of context. $25 billion in the first fiscal year sounds like a lot. $900 billion over the course of 10 years sounds like a lot. But when you're looking at a federal budget where you spend this year, I think, something in the neighborhood of $3.7 trillion, is that a lot?
Right. You know, certainly the $25 billion, I think one could say, is definitely not a lot. And that's why I don't think you'll feel big repercussions in this first fiscal year for this program. And, you know, that's one of the complaints. You know, certainly on the Republican side, one of the complaints is, okay, so, you know, terrific that it was all done by spending cuts. I think that Republicans, and particularly members of the Tea Party, can be grateful for that. That's certainly what they wanted. They wanted to reduce government spending. But, you know, even, you know, a number of Republicans didn't vote for this. Members of the Tea Party said it didn't go far enough. So you really get complaints from the far left and the far right that it didn't do enough.
We're talking with Melissa Miller this morning about the effects of the debt ceiling deal that was worked out over the weekend. We've been hearing details of it coming out over the past couple of days. The question now, of course, is what is the impact going to be on the average person? And Melissa Miller says, at first, average Americans aren't going to be noticing too awfully much. We'll be talking with her more about those effects and what we might see as we head down the road. Let's take a look now at Wisconsin weather for the rest of today. It is going to be sunny later on. Expect highs today in the mid-80s, but it will be cooler near the Great Lakes. Tonight, it is going to be clear. Expect some fog possible in the southern part of Wisconsin. Lows will be dropping down into the mid-50s in the northland to about mid-60s in the south. And then on Thursday, partly cloudy skies. Highs will be in the mid-80s. And once again, it should be cooler near the Great Lakes. Around Wisconsin right now, it's 71 degrees in Green Bay, 63 in Superior, 67 in Wausau. At Oshkosh, it is 71, 66 degrees in Eau Claire, 74 in La Crosse, 71 in Madison, and in Milwaukee, it's 73. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 18 minutes past 6 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, here today filling in for Joy Cardine. We're talking about the debt ceiling debate. Now that it's over with, it's a done deal, as they say. What happens next? There are a few things happening next, including the super committee, the so-called super committee, that will be doing its work in the next couple of months and making recommendations about other places to cut. And as President Obama pointed out at his news conference yesterday, even though they've reached a deal so far, he does say he doesn't think the budget can be balanced just on the middle class.
It's the budget on the backs of the very people who have borne the biggest brunt of this recession. We can't make it tougher for young people to go to college, or ask seniors to pay more for health care, or ask scientists to give up on promising medical research because we couldn't close a tax shelter for the most fortunate among us. Everyone's going to have to chip in.
Everyone is going to have to chip in. Melissa Miller is with us this hour, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and we are talking with her about what happens next. And Melissa Miller, when the president says everyone's going to have to chip in, does this get back to sort of the dissatisfaction that both sides feel about where we are at this particular moment in time?
Well, it certainly does, and I think that's certainly the president is trying to signal that tax increases must be part of a package that the super committee comes up with. So there were no tax increases or closing of tax loopholes in this initial part of the deal, to the great disappointment of Democrats. I think by saying that the burden must be shared, you know, the president using language like this cannot be all put on the middle class, you know, that's a signal to the super committee that at this next stage, it must be a balanced approach that combines further spending cuts, which I'm sure that the plan will include, with tax increases, the closing of tax loopholes, perhaps tax hikes on the wealthy and so forth. And that's the big question, really, I think. That's the big mystery is, you know, that the Democrats are deeply disappointed that they didn't get any, there was no, you know, using the tax code on one side of the ledger to get these initial cuts to be part of this initial plan. And the big complaint among Democrats is that, you know, the president, you know, that was what he said had to be part of the plan. It had to be a balanced approach. And it turned out to be, you know, 100% in the form of spending cuts. And so I think the big question is, you know, will the Republicans be able to accomplish the same kind of plan at the next stage? Because that's really where, you know, there are bigger cuts yet to come. They have to, whether it's all in spending cuts or it's a combination of spending cuts and tax hikes, they've got to come up with between $1.2 and $1.5 trillion in further deficit reduction by November, or these automatic across-the-board cuts will be triggered. So it remains to be seen, but it also underscores how important the composition of that super committee is going to be.
And it's so one impact we can safely say that the average American is going to be feeling in the next month or two is a continuing debate on this as the super committee takes form and starts talking about essentially a lot of the same issues we've been talking about for the past few months.
Absolutely. I mean, in some respects, although we've all abided weeks, really, of countdown clocks and the like, the drama really will continue. And, you know, I don't think it's going anywhere. And I also anticipate that, you know, late Sunday night and then through yesterday, this was really an 11th-hour deal, right down to the wire. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the players run this right down to the wire again in November, in part because, you know, these are tough problems, okay? So, you know, part of it is understandable, but I think also Americans get rather frustrated at the process, at what they perceive to be gridlock. And yet, boy, it seems to me that the super committee is almost designed, dare I say, for more gridlock. It's hard to imagine a world in which the Republican leaders in the House and Senate would put, shall we say, flexible, you know, Republican representatives on that committee who are willing to compromise. And likewise, will the Democratic leadership put, you know, flexible compromisers on the committee? You know, I rather doubt it. I suspect that both will try to put their best players on the committee so that they can get the best deal out of it. But that may mean that the committee is comprised of legislators who are not very willing to compromise. So, Yeah, boy, you know, it just remains to be seen, and that'll be big news to see who those names are going on that committee.
800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones, and Paul is with us from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, your guest is absolutely correct what you just said about the Republicans on the super committee. They will appoint from the Teabag Party, they will all be there. And if you only have to see what's going to happen with the super committee, you only have to see what's happened to the FFA, or the FAA, excuse me, the Federal Aeronautics Administration. There's been Republicans are unhappy. They say about subsidies for small airports, but it's really about unions and being able to organize unions easier in the airline industry. They don't like that. So they have held up the authorization for the FAA. It will cost, because they didn't take action, it'll cost the federal government $1 billion in money that they've collected. This will all, it is currently all going to the airline industry. Over 70,000 construction workers across the country have been laid off because there's no authorization for their improvements at airports. This is the kind of government that the Republicans want, and this is what we'll get from the super committee. Like Keith Ellison said, this is a Satan sandwich.
Paul, thanks for the call. And Melissa Miller, you know, Paul brings up the FAA example. I mean, is that a sign of things to come?
You know, possibly. It's just an example of the intractable nature of a lot of these issues. I actually want to touch on something he said right at the very beginning of the comment, which was that, boy, the Tea Party, they'll all be there on the committee. True in part. I would agree with the caller in part. I think that, you know, with Republicans getting six seats on the super committee, three from the House, three from the Senate, I suspect at least one of those seats will be somebody clearly aligned with the Tea Party. Because, you know, although they complained about the deal, although a number of them did not vote for it, to the extent that there are winners and losers here, most are saying that the Tea Party actually won. It's just ironic that they might not say that themselves, but I think that they demonstrated their political clout in this case. So they, unfortunately, on one of their signature issues, which was not raising the debt ceiling, well, it is raised by the deal. But on the other hand, the deal was accomplished strictly through spending cuts in the first stage, and as well, they got a mandatory vote on a balanced budget amendment that will have to be held by law before the first of the year. So there is a lot that they did achieve. I think they will be represented on the super committee. The other thing that I'll say, the caller, Paul, talked about construction jobs and, you know, jobs for working Americans to be affected. And that's one thing that for discretionary spending, what we're going to see, no doubt, is cuts to things like transportation, infrastructure improvements. So when he mentioned construction jobs, that is very much probably a place that will be hurt by the deal.
We have a comment from Ray on Facebook. He writes, we racked up almost $4 trillion in debt over the past 2 years. The debt is still going up by $2 trillion more in the next year and a half, and there's a cut of $900 billion. Only in liberal land is an increase of debt spending called a cut. The Republicans caved again, so there's a conservative who doesn't really feel like a winner.
Well, and in part, you know, points to something kind of important. It's, you know, it, what the plan does is more slow the growth of the national debt rather than really bring it down. It's not that we won't, you know, it's just going to grow at a slower rate. And when you do the numbers, you know, there's some truth in what the caller says, that, you know, the debt doesn't go away. And in fact, that's why many conservatives, many members, adherents of the Tea Party are disappointed, you know, very disappointed in the deal, that it doesn't go far enough. And, you know, one of the things that's being said coming from those quarters is the deal does not cut any, you know, single program outright. It doesn't really overhaul any program or reform it. So that, you know, that's true to the criticism of the plan from the right.
Let's go back to the phones right now. And Laverne is with us from Monroe. Good morning.
Hello, Gene. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
I agree with the first caller. I think this here, the super reduction bill they just passed, is just kind of a big joke, because this problem really started better than 10 years ago when President Bush was president and he lowered the taxes from 40% down to 25%. And this super committee that which they talk about is probably just about like the Gang of Six was when they wanted to lower the taxes from 35% down to 28%, to put putting all the burden on the middle class, and the rich are getting by with murder because they got the money to buy the lobbyists down there at Washington.
All right, Laverne, there you go. And Melissa Miller, another side heard from.
Well, it's interesting that the caller brought up lobbyists, because I think we will see some of the most intense lobbying between now and November that's been seen ever, probably on Capitol Hill. We think we only got a taste of the lobbying that's to come. And you know, I think there's truth in that. There's absolutely no question that now we'll have intense focus on these 12 negotiators, and the lobbyists will bring their interests to bear on that process and try to get the best outcome for themselves. So I think there's truth in that. You know, the caller also mentioned that, you know, this problem has been a long time in the coming, and I think I would have to agree with the caller on that. But for so many reasons, presidents under both, you know, Democratic and Republican administrations have, you know, engaged in deficit spending often, you know, and this has been true for Bush, true for Clinton. Deficits are run up in part because of wartime spending. You know, that was true in World War II as it is today, that, you know, which is one reason why I mentioned the balanced budget amendment, that mandatory vote a few minutes ago. And while I don't expect that to go anywhere, I don't think that we'll get a constitutional amendment to have a balanced budget. But one of the reasons that a balanced budget amendment is so problematic is because it would really hamstring a president, be they Republican or Democrat, during time of crisis, whether it's an economic crisis or a national defense kind of crisis, a time of war, or what have you. So plenty of blame to go around, I think, in terms of why we got to this point.
And plenty of things to talk about. Melissa Miller is with us this hour, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University. And we are talking about what happens next now that the debt ceiling deal has been reached. Super Committee is going to be going to work in November. We can expect something. And we'll be talking about what we might expect over the next couple of months with Melissa Miller. We'd like to get your calls, too. We'll be taking a break for news and then coming back to the topic. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number. You can also find us on email, talk@WPR.org, and you can follow The Joy Cardine Show on Facebook. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 24 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Melissa Miller this hour, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University, about the debt ceiling deal and what happens next and what the impacts on this that average Americans are going to be feeling and hearing over the next couple of months. We'll be taking your calls, too, in just a moment, 800-642-1234. And Melissa Miller, I don't know if you were listening during the newscast, but there was a quote there, a soundbite from Harry Reid, who was talking about the makeup of the super committee that we'd been discussing throughout the half hour. And he said the important thing for the members of the super committee is to set aside politics. And I got to ask you, is that going to happen?
Oh, a little bit of a pipe dream there, I think, on the part of Harry Reid, in the sense that, you know, as I said a few minutes ago, it's hard to imagine that members of the leadership in the House and Senate, given, you know, they each chamber gets six seats, three for Democrats, three for Republicans. You know, it'd be interesting to hear if a caller disagrees, are they likely to put moderates on the committee, you know, send a moderate Democrat or a moderate Republican to the committee? Boy, I just don't see that happening. I just feel like they're going to want to put their best, strongest negotiators in those slots. You know, I'd have to disagree respectfully with Harry Reid on this one. I'd like to see that happen, because I think then you're more likely to get a deal that isn't felt like it really disadvantages one group or over another, that is more balanced in approach. But I don't really anticipate that happening.
800-642-1234 is our toll-free number. And Melissa Miller, are you hearing any names yet about possible candidates for this super committee?
You know, some names are being tossed around, but one thing that I have heard, and I, you know, come to think of it, is probably fairly obvious. The one type of senator or member of Congress that will definitely not be put on the committee, I've already said that it's unlikely that moderates will be put on. Mm-hmm. It's also unlikely that anybody facing a tough re-election challenge in 2012 would be put on. I think the leadership of both chambers will avoid putting anybody in such a hot seat where there's a lot to lose as well as a lot to win. You wouldn't want to put somebody who's facing a tough re-election battle in there. I think it's more likely to be members of the House and Senate who are already, you know, players in the debate. So, you know, those would come from the budget committees, for instance. You know, Paul Ryan's name.
Sure.
I've heard, you know, for sure. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Paul Ryan was on the committee. So I think that they're going to probably be familiar names that have already been, you know, a big part of the process. Not likely to be moderates, and not likely to be anybody who's in trouble in terms of their reelection, because both parties really want to preserve the seats they have, and both are hoping to gain more seats in 2012.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Clyde joins us from Hurley. Good morning, Clyde.
Good morning. I'm wondering if the super commission is going to be deemed constitutional, because if they have an up and down vote on their recommendation and Congress with no discussion from Congress, I don't know if there's a bunch of judges out there that want to get a hold of this and call it non-constitutional.
Clyde, thanks for the call. And Melissa Miller, what about that? The committee makes a vote all by itself. Is that taking Congress too far out of the picture?
Well, Clyde poses a really interesting question, because I think one of the things is that, you know, this process is different. You know, it resembles the base closing process,
mm-hmm.
and the military base closing process was sort of a model for this one. But let's think about it, and I urge the caller to think about it slightly differently. You might want to think about it like a conference committee, okay? So normally legislation passes, one version passes the House, one version passes the Senate, and then it's taken up in a conference committee where members of both chambers hammer out the differences, and then it's that conference committee version that goes to a vote. Well, this process is very much like the regular old conference committee process, save for two important big exceptions, and I'm sure this is what the caller is thinking. The first big exception is that you're short-circuiting that process, where the House and Senate get to pass separate versions of the bill, and all of the members of each chamber are part of that process, either through their individual committees, subcommittee work, or certainly through each of the chambers getting to vote, all of the members being able to vote. So it bypasses that process. And second, the way the Budget Control Act of 2011, which is what this is called, is written, says that if the plan that the super committee comes up with does not get approval by both chambers, then this trigger goes off, and then there will be these automatic and deep across-the-board cuts. So the caller's question, you know, is it constitutional? You know, well, that's kind of interesting, because one thing about the Constitution is, for instance, there's no provision in the Constitution that, let's say, you know, a piece of legislation has to go through a congressional committee structure or subcommittees. Those aren't even mentioned in the Constitution. So, you know, at this point, I'd have to say, you know, it may end up in the courts. I'm not hearing a lot that that's an enormous problem, or that really dooms the process altogether. No, I'm not hearing that.
On the other hand, we have a long way to go.
Yeah, so. There's a long way to go. Absolutely, there's a long way to go. So, you know, it is, you know, one way to think about it, it's kind of like having a conference committee. One of the criticisms is that, you know, not every member of Congress is going to be able to be part of the process up front, that you're taking, you know, 535 people and winnowing them down to just 12 who get to decide on this deal. And then it's an up or down vote. So while it's a very streamlined process, it may be considered a very efficient process. I think part of what Clyde may be getting at is it may seem a little bit, you know, less democratic than a process in which every member of Congress, you know, can. Now, really, when you think about it, you know, when a bill goes through Congress, the real players on the bill are those who sit on the committees that that bill gets directed to. So it's not like every member of Congress gets to have a big influence on every piece of legislation. But on the other hand, you know, this process short-circuits that committee structure that we're all familiar with and some of those avenues for constituents to have input and so forth. So instead, constituents will all be bringing to bear their opinions when this committee comes up with a plan that is subject to a vote. And, you know, there will be a big campaign, probably for and against, and many opportunities for the public to weigh in on, you know, how their members of Congress ought to vote on that final package.
800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim now, who is with us from Kenosha. Good morning.
Good morning. Most economists seem to think that some level of debt is acceptable for a country, but they disagree on what that level would be. And yet we have a very extreme conservative group, the Tea Party, that seems to believe that no level of debt is acceptable. That's a very extreme position reflective of their view of government as being extremely limited, if at all, in some cases. And so these people were willing to risk the economic viability of the whole country for that extreme belief. So your guest used the talk before about the extreme left and the extreme right, and I hear this on TV too, and it just seems like from a political perspective and from a political science point of view, the current crop of, quote, extreme Republicans, extreme Democrats, the extreme Republicans are much farther right on a traditional political spectrum than Democrats who merely support a very traditional view regarding the maintenance of Social Security, Medicare, and other commonly accepted and historical social programs in this country. And yet they continue to be talked about as if they're equal, instead of calling out the Tea Party for the extreme conservatives that they are in the history of the country and their extreme views about the limits of government.
Melissa Miller, what about that? Are we seeing new definitions of extreme here?
Well, I think we are. Well, and what Jim says is correct, is in that those on the far right who didn't vote for it and those on the far left who didn't vote for this deal did so for very different reasons. And I think the caller articulated that fairly well, which is, you know, members of the House and Senate who align themselves with the Tea Party, for them, you know, voting against it had a lot to do with the fact that the debt ceiling got raised and they didn't think it needed to be raised at all. And, you know, on the other hand, members of the House and Senate on the Democratic side who voted against it, they were, you know, voting against it because they felt that it was not a balanced approach. Well, those, as Jim says, are very different reasons. Now, one thing that the Tea Party got, and I think that the caller suggested that members of the Tea Party are very rigid, and clearly the caller is troubled, as many are, with the rigidity of the Tea Party's position that no debt spending is acceptable. One of the wins for them in this bill is that Congress has to vote now on a balanced budget amendment. And, you know, that's really been a linchpin of what the Tea Party stands for, that the Constitution should have this balanced budget amendment so that there's never any debt, there's never any deficit spending. And I don't think that that's going anywhere. Although, you know, many Americans, in fact, a vast majority of Americans, in theory, like the idea of a balanced budget amendment. And so the Tea Party adherents could argue that, gosh, we've got most of the country behind us. You know, I think the support for that sort of no debt whatsoever position is pretty shallow, okay? So there were polls done earlier this summer that said about three-quarters of Americans supported a balanced budget amendment. But the minute you ask those same survey respondents who support a balanced budget amendment whether they would be, whether they would accept cuts to programs like Social Security and Medicare, absolutely not is the response that you get. So, you know, on the one hand, just taking that one example, it would appear that many in the public, you know, ironically do seem to support what the Tea Party supports in the form of this balanced budget amendment, but that support is so shallow. It's really, you know, it will dissipate once that debate really begins on the balanced budget amendment. I think it's not going anywhere. So that, what Jim might call that really extreme position, when Congress votes on the balanced budget amendment, I don't think the Tea Party will be celebrating a victory at all at that point.
And we'll want to pick up on that point after we take this short break. Melissa Miller is with us this morning, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University. And we are talking about the debt ceiling deal and what happens next for average Americans. Taking a look at Wisconsin weather, it's going to be sunny today. Expect highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, clear skies. Fog is possible in the south. Back down to the mid-50s in the north to the mid-60s in the south. Then on Thursday, it'll be partly cloudy with highs in the mid-80s. Around Wisconsin right now, it's 72 in Green Bay. It's 67 degrees in Superior, 67 as well in Wausau. It's 72 in Oshkosh, 66 in Eau Claire, 74 in La Crosse, 71 in Madison, and 73 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10 minutes before 7 o'clock, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 7, it's time for this week's big question. My guests of opposing perspectives will debate whether insurance companies should be required to provide contraceptives with no copays. The big question coming up after 7 o'clock. For the rest of this hour, we are talking about the debt ceiling deal and where it will go next and what sort of impact this will have on average Americans. Melissa Miller joins us, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University, and we'll be getting to calls in just a moment. Melissa Miller, right before the break, we were talking about the balanced budget amendment and the likelihood of it passing. And no matter what happens with that vote, I suspect we'll be hearing a lot about it in the 2012 elections.
Oh, we will. You know, one thing's for certain, and one thing's for certain about what the Tea Party, that's come up a lot with the callers, have achieved throughout this process, and that is they've really gotten a voice in this process. And many would argue that they've shifted the terms of the debate, and that's what's so disappointing to so many Democrats, particularly progressive Democrats, many of them who voted against it in the House and Senate, was that deficit reduction, and you know, this is a difference when 15 years ago or so the balanced budget amendment was kicked around back then, and yet at that time both tax cuts and tax increases and spending cuts were part of that dialogue, and it feels like, and to the frustration of some of the callers who've called in, I'm sensing that it feels like the focus of the conversation has shifted almost exclusively to spending cuts. At the very top of the show, President Obama was quoted as saying, this must be a balanced approach. This can't be all on the backs of the middle Americans. And I think that's what remains to be seen. And that's what the Democrats are hoping, that at this next stage, at the super committee stage, they can get the balance that they didn't get in the first stage. That's a combination of spending cuts and tax increases, closing of tax loopholes, and that sort of thing.
Vernon joins us now from New London. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
You're on the air.
Okay. What I rarely hear anybody on the TV media talk about is how the wealthy in this country, which is, I define it as the top 3 to 5%, have paid little or no taxes for the last 25 years since the 86 Tax Reform Act was passed. And also, the main blame for the problems in this country is that people don't vote. That's the main problem. And the debt limit thing, the debt limit had nothing to do with future spending. It was paying our bills, and that's what my question is. Thank you.
Vernon, thanks for the call. And Melissa Miller, he brings up a couple of points there, but I want to touch upon the whole voting issue. Do you think that this issue, kind of where we are now, is going to get more people to become active, to become part of the process?
Oh, I think that, in fact, you know, one of the downsides to all the drama and controversy is that, you know, we have to listen to all the drama and the controversy. But at the same time, sometimes these are the kinds of issues, these are the kinds of controversies and crises that really get voters to, you know, stay tuned and to pay attention and to get mobilized to vote. So you take, for instance, this crisis in combination with the crises that are being faced in states like Wisconsin and Ohio, big debates over, you know, the right of public employees to unionize and so forth. And I'll tell you what, I expect that it will be a lot easier for both parties to mobilize under these kinds of crisis situations. So You know, Vernon's right, though, that, you know, voter participation in this country is arguably not where it should be. It, you know, it's among the industrialized democracies, voter turnout in the United States is ranked among the lowest. And I think, though, that what's frustrating to Vernon is, you know, why aren't tax hikes on the wealthy part of this? Well, I think in fact that's what the Democrats have been trying to get to be part of the process, and it didn't end up being part of this deal, to Vernon's frustration, I'm sure, and to others' frustration. So it's not that, you know, the Democrats aren't trying to use the tax code and, in fact, to raise taxes among the very wealthy, but they weren't successful in doing so. Will that motivate other people to vote? You know, a lot will come down to mobilization, but I think that the middle class is ripe for mobilization because of the debt crisis situation, because of the crises that states like Wisconsin and Ohio are facing, that have to do with public employees, their right to unionize, the manner in which governors and state houses are trying to balance budgets. So I think, in fact, that this could help with mobilization, could help get more people to vote, perhaps not in huge numbers. You know, I'm not saying that voting turnout will go up by 10-20%, but, you know, even marginal increases are probably a good thing.
Let's go to Rick now from Elkhart Lake. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I just find it kind of galling that they call this a compromise agreement. A compromise to me would have been 50% cut in spending, a 50% increase in taxes. The second thing, I'm just so disappointed in President Obama. He had said at the beginning of this there was going to be tax hikes on the wealthiest of Americans. He was the same one who said he would make sure that there was a public option in the health care bill. He gave in earlier in January when they were thinking about cutting or disbanding the Bush tax cut. So now he says, well, we're going to increase the, anything in the future is going to be tax increase on the wealthiest, more of a fair tax system or whatever. I won't believe it till I see it. And the way it's going, no, I voted for Obama, but I won't in the future. Thank you.
Rick, thanks for the call. And Melissa Miller, I think that's a pretty common theme we've been hearing some lately. A lot of folks disappointed in the president.
You know, absolutely. I think Rick really, you know, sort of eloquently stated what many Obama supporters have been thinking, which is, boy, it just seems like when these big deals get negotiated, whether it was health care or the Bush tax cuts or whether it was this debt ceiling plan, Obama seems to take a position, and then somehow it doesn't end up in the final bill. And I think this was what Vernon, the prior caller, was suggesting as well. Why weren't tax increases, particularly on the very wealthy, part of this package? And I think that the president is open to criticism on that score. Now, you know, boy, the problem for Obama politically moving forward is that I think the base is disappointed. The liberal base of supporters who supported him in 2008 feel like he's become too much of a compromiser, gave too much away. Now, you know, interestingly, in the last couple of days, he's trying to emphasize, boy, you know, I'm the voice of reason. I'm the compromiser. I'm the adult in the group. And you know, that's certainly what he campaigned on in 2008, rising above the fray and so forth. But he may be facing a little bit of trouble with his base because they're deeply disappointed with some of these, you know, the big packages that have come through. One of the things that's come up is, you know, people don't vote. And I think Obama's concern right now politically ought to be that he really needs to make sure that his base is mobilized to turn out and vote for him. I mean, he's going to be a president running with, you know, by all counts, a pretty high unemployment rate. I don't know that that's going to be reversed in the next, you know, in the next 12 months or so. And so I think it is politically problematic for the president. You know, it may appeal to independents in the middle that he compromised, but the base, I think, this isn't that appealing to them.
And we've got to leave it there. Melissa Miller, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Melissa Miller's been with us, a political science professor at Bowling Green State University. We've been talking about the deficit ceiling deal. Chris Molina provided us with on-air production this hour. Bill Martin's produced the hour. And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.